plan to practice, you know, in this area. Mm-hmm. You know, so there is a military population here. And so I'm really interested to learn more about, you know, PTSD, because I really don't know a whole lot about it.
Well, this is going to be, this will apply. I have to catch a flight, so I have to leave pretty close to the 505, because I'm flying out of Dulles at 8. But my name is Christy, and I am in the doctoral program in counselor education and supervision at Liberty University. My husband and I minister to families who have adopted or are providing kinship care for children with severe emotional or behavioral disturbances. And you're going to see a lot when you're talking about military populations. Just by virtue of the fact that the military moves, even if they're not in a combat situation and dad is overseas, but they move every 2 years, and the kids have, I think, a higher than average level, not necessarily reactive attachment disorder, but just attachment issues, because they go to school and they're there for 2 years and then they move and they leave everybody behind. And by the time they're adolescents or pre-adolescents, they're like, I'm not going to get connected because I don't want to have a best friend because I'm just going to leave in 2 years anyhow. And so we deal with a lot of military families, but I hope you're recording it because
I'm
cut out. But in any case, the diagnosis that our children come with is usually reactive attachment disorder or disinhibited social engagement disorder. So as you're learning through that, those are the new hot button topics that are in. I graduated in the master's program in August of 2014, and they were kind of sort of hot button topics. Attachment. Are you getting a lot in that in your classes right
now? Yes.
It's the button, and I think it's a spectrum. It's not just you either have reactive attachment disorder or you don't. I think you're going to find working with wives, you know, that give the husband the silent treatment. There's some attachment issues. They didn't learn how to, you know, you're going to see a lot of conflict in adult couples that are rooted in childhood attachment issues. There's a couple objectives I'm going to try and meet. This chair is really making a lot of noise. So the audience will be able to recognize the diagnostic criteria of post-traumatic stress disorder as opposed to reactive attachment disorder. When I say RAD, I'm talking about both the inhibited and the disinhibited. So I don't know if you've gotten into psychopathology yet, but they're also going to be able to explain how reactive behaviors are rooted in safety issues, perceived or real, critique the concept that the inside matches the outside, and give examples of how that may present with reactive children, and evaluate the theory of using holistic whole family systemic approaches. So when we talk about like family systems. So these are a couple of pictures, and most of them are pictures of fear or anger. That little one we're gonna hopefully have time to talk about. That is a child whose primal needs obviously haven't been met. He's hungry, but you know, attachment doesn't necessarily have to come from abuse. It can come from caregiver maltreatment in the form of neglect. And a lot of times neglect is sometimes got more emotional scars. Because y'all are students, all of us are students of psychology and in the counseling realms, these are the primary diagnostic criteria for the DSM-5. And what I've highlighted in red are the ones that we see in clinical practice. So I have a life experience that supersedes what I learned in a book in school. It just doesn't touch upon it. But when we see these kids that are diagnosed RAD, they are inhibited, emotion withdrawn, usually towards adult caregivers, but often towards anybody in a meaningful way. They have minimal social emotional responsiveness, limited positive affect, episodes of unexplained irritability, sadness, or fearfulness. And of course, C, they have patterns of insufficient care. But one of the things that I see in here is that it doesn't really look pathological. I mean, this could describe a kid who has a social anxiety, who's not attached. This could describe a child with Asperger's who doesn't attach, right? There's nothing really where you look and you say, ooh, that kid has RAD. And the same is true for disinhibited social engagement disorder. These are the criteria in red. They're reduced or absent reticence in approaching and interacting with unfamiliar adults. They go up and they do it. They have no fear. They walk up, hey, how are you? They overly familiar verbal or physical behavior. They may run up and give strangers hugs or grab somebody's hand or sit in somebody's lap that they don't know. Diminished or absent checking back with an adult caregiver. So they'll run off and not look back. Where's mom? Is mom? Willingness to go off with an unfamiliar adult. And obviously the well, they also have to have pathological caregiving. That's not on here, but it's not, you can exclude it if they have ADHD. But again, it's not pathological. You look at that and you think, well, it's just a social butterfly, an overly friendly child that doesn't have good boundaries. But there's an element of disinhibited social engagement disorder that's incredibly pathological. They're very exploitive and very manipulative, and we'll talk about that in a minute. So the criterion of post-traumatic stress disorder, there's five that I listed on here, the ABs, the criterion A, B, and C. And again, the stuff in red, if I have a child who's been diagnosed by a psychologist with RAD, and I want to look at it from a PTSD perspective, the first criterion is the child had to actually physically, personally experience or hear stories about, in the case of PTSD with children, that he was exposed to physical injury, sexual abuse, you know, violence. So the criterion A is met by definition of them having suffered the treatment that caused RAD. They have recurrent upsetting intrusive memories, recurrent upsetting dreams, intense physiological or psychological distress with triggers that get triggered. Criterion C, they avoid efforts of remembering or thoughts or feelings that bring up the rejection or betrayal or the abuse. Criterion D is they have persistent and exaggerated negative beliefs or expectations about themselves or others. I'm no good. Nobody's going to love me. Mom, I had 6 foster parents who ejected me. Nobody knew. New mom's not going to love me either. Or mom's abandoned. I had 6 foster moms before you that abandoned me. That's what moms do. How bad do I have to be before you're going to abandon me too? So they have those kind of things going on. Feelings of detachment. How we talk about reactive attachment disorder, they're not attached. That's a PTSD criterion D right there, is they're detached. And E is one of the most incredible things. It took me through the master's program and really researching this population, because what you don't see in the diagnostic criteria for RAD and DSED are these things: irritable behavior and angry outbursts, verbal or physical aggression, reckless or self-destructive behavior. These are conduct disorder behaviors. This is what you see when a kid comes into an office and the parent says, I can't live with them anymore. This is what you see, not the detached, not bonding. You see kids that are burning down houses, that are killing pets. You see kids that are threatening to kill themselves or others, using threats to intimidate their adults. The conduct disorder, which is that criterion E, is really the clinical presentation. So this slide talks about, I mean, it just talks about how the criterion meets diagnostically post-traumatic stress disorder. It more accurately depicts the pathology. But there's only 4 studies worldwide talking about post-traumatic stress from early childhood trauma. There's a ton talking about combat trauma. There's a ton, and I'm not diminishing that. There's a ton talking about, you know, Hurricane Katrina and the flooding or whatever in Indonesia, that tsunami that came through. There's a ton that talks about natural disasters and 9/11 that talk about PTSD. But as far as caregiver neglect and abuse against the child, there's only 4. All 4 studies were done on adult women who had been sexually abused by a caregiver. And the thing about that is that they were adults. They weren't living under the care and control of an abuser. Whereas children with reactive attachment disorder that have been adopted out of foster care or an orphanage, they're living with a new caregiver that in their mind could potentially abuse or neglect them. They don't have a choice. They didn't agree to get adopted. But here they are in their own little combat zone. So there is a link between dysfunctional attachment and the development of PTSD, but there's not enough information. And then some of the statistics were a little bit alarming for me. This is Department of Health and Human Services. This isn't some school kid that comes up with some stuff. 1 million children in the United States a year suffer substantiated abuse. I was horrified. 33% worldwide of kids are physically abused, 25% of girls sexually abused.
How young?
I don't know, 0 to 18. United Nations, that's a report from the United Nations, and then of course the Andrea.
And I would also speculate that those statistics would actually be higher because a lot of people don't report that stuff. They don't want to report it, they don't even want to think about it.
Right, and I think some of that last one with the United Nations, I think some of that's speculative because we don't know from all the third world countries, but 25%, woe to us, God's people. 25%, that's disturbing.
Well, the million figure sounds low.
The million, substantiated. Proven, substantiated, not reported.
Okay.
So we're going to talk about, there's some more statistics we'll talk about. So the underlying issues, which are not addressed in the DSM-5, are a lack of trust and the fact that the child doesn't feel safe in his home environment for any multitude of reasons. And that could be, you know, the new mom may want to be, she might be really soft, she might want to give him a chance to acclimate, and he thinks, oh my goodness, she's not strong enough to protect me. You know, or she could be really harsh, and he triggers back and says, oh my goodness, this lady's going to kill me. She's going to suffocate me like other caregivers in the past. So I believe that's what causes reactive attachment disorder. The research that does exist fails to really hone in, and I think this is the thing. The contributory factors involving the interpersonal behavior of the child by his or her first caregivers that were supposed to protect him, and now he's under the care of new caregivers. So I believe reactive attachment disorder is foundationally PTSD from ECT. So why does it matter? I work in the field. I'm graduated. I work in the field. We started as therapeutic foster parents. Why it matters is because there's no treatment. There's zero treatment. No research, no empirical treatment for treating reactive attachment disorder whatsoever. The current treatment consists of keeping the child in the home as long as possible and then putting him in an institution long-term residential treatment until he ages out 5, 6, 8 years later. Now you release him to the general public after he's never really learned to bond with people in a meaningful way. He's got conduct disorder kind of things, which turns into antisocial personality disorder stuff. We might talk about that if we have time. What we see in our ministry is that there is a fringe of attachment therapists that are licensed professionals that find this niche. And they say, oh, these people who've adopted have a lot of money. And they are desperate, and they will do anything to save the money and not be a failure. We could talk about your model.
Yeah.
And so we're going to charge 5 of the last 6 kids we've had in care. So we in ministry, we will take in one child that's on the extreme end of the spectrum, and we will take him in residentially to live in our family. And we'll help him learn to respect authority, learn to express anger appropriately without hurting anyone or breaking anything. But 90% of my work is with the parents, and we're going to talk about that. But 5 of the last 6 kids we had in care came through from families who had gone to the same set of partners in Atlanta, attachment therapists, $40,000 and up in 5 years. They, hey mom, you're a saint, and they, oh we are, we need to edify these moms. They're exhausted, they're abused, absolutely horrifically, secondary PTSD right there. But the counselor comes in, you're just a saint. I would pinch his head off. Nobody understands you. But what they're doing is they're demonizing the child, and they're saying it's all the kid's fault. This kid is broken. They call him Blackheart. I've been in therapy with them. I've been in sessions with them. It's unbelievable the amount of damage and destruction that's being done in the name of licensed clinical attachment therapists to these families that are desperate. And then they'll do for $10,000. They'll do an intensive week-long session, which is just long enough to stir up anger, but not long enough to resolve it. And they got their money in the bank and they send them off. And these families are dissolving left and right. So statistically, here's one of the problems with the research that is out there. Charles Zena, he was the chair of the committee with the APA that determined with the DSM-5 what the new, because they switched it, mm-hmm. they split it into inhibit and disinhibit. So he's kind of critical to know. But his research is so inconsistent. On one hand, he says it's exceedingly rare. And on the other hand, he agrees with Lake and Smike that talk about it being 38 to 40% of all children in foster care. Well, if you look at this, 460,000 new children enter foster care, not on any given time. Those are new kids a year. If you apply that 40%, that's 184,000 new children that could have RAD here in the United States. And I'm not sure exactly why, but all the research that is on RAD is about Romania. There's some on Chile, there's some on Ukraine, there's none in the United States. What are we gonna do with Romanian orphanage? How are we gonna apply that to our population? We don't have institutions like they do. Foster care is totally different. But for some reason, they keep going back, I'm not sure I understand that. But this study says they think that 1% of all children worldwide, Hollinger, suffer from reactive attachment disorder. There's 2.2 billion children, 0 to 18, according to UNICEF. And that's actually 2013, not 2003. That means there's 22 million. That is anything but rare. I mean, you'd think one kid here or one kid in Kansas might have it. But here's a statistic. With all of the hysteria about autism, it only affects 1% of the population as well. And yet it's got the funding and it's got the attention of the legislators and it's got all the parents, all these tools and resources. But the parents that are adopting these kids, they have nothing but judgment and condemnation. And I'm a Christian, but a lot of it comes from the church. And not, you know, when experts are condemning them and creating to failure, there's a problem. 11 to 36% of all adoptions in the United States fail. That includes infant adoptions, by the way. 11%. One out of every 10, more than one out of every 10 adoptions, including infant adoptions, 36% is teenagers. The 5,150 with the $200 million a year, that is the number of children that was in residential treatment care for attachment disorder, for disturbances in Georgia, Tennessee, and Florida in 2012. Last year, it went up slightly, but extrapolating that over the course of, you know, that was three states. So if all 50 states are spending the same amount of money to institutionalize kids and keep them away from bonding and not help them become, they're not going to become good employees or employers or spouses or parents because they didn't learn how to bond. $3 billion a year, we taxpayers should know about this and say somebody's got to do something different. So the treatment implications, you know, rather than sending kids off into residential treatment, we seriously, seriously oppose residential treatment. I know we do it, but not in an institutional setting. And the treatment becomes systemic. So it's the whole family system. We're gonna talk about the primary ones that we work with. Psychoeducation of parents. And one of the things I looked at, do you have a JOMSMA treatment planner? I left mine in the car because it was so heavy and I was carrying stuff. But one of the things, I mean, this makes sense because I live this. I'm out of a classroom. I'm in the doctoral classroom, but I work in full-time ministry with this. And this makes sense when you look at it, but then you get the treatment. Are you familiar with JOMSMA?
No.
Oh, well, when you get to psychopathology and diagnosis and stuff, JOMSMA is like the Bible of treatment planners. This guy, his name is Art JOMSMA. He's got a whole
bunch of... Is it J-O-H-N-S-M-A?
J-O-N-G-S-M-A. Everybody in your program above you is going to, when you get to there, everybody's going to know who that is.
Okay.
But they have treatment planners where you can look at and you can say, I have, you know, I have a children one, an adolescent one, they have an adult one, they have addictions, pastoral, sexual abuse, they have them, PTSD. And what they do is you look at it and you say, huh, I wish I had it for you now. This child has reactive attachment disorder. What are the goals and the objectives and the treatment? So when you start writing treatment plans and you have to come up with the goals and the objectives and the treatment interventions, that's where you're gonna go if you're smart.
Nice. So it gives you like a broad outline that's based in research.
Oh, it's brilliant, yes.
Or is it more
it's
specific?
It's thorough.
Really?
It's thorough, I wish I had it.
Yeah, no, I mean, I've taken a lot of notes today. This is, like I said, my first conference, so I didn't bring a notebook. But yeah, I'm learning a lot of new things today, so I will definitely look that
up. Well, I had my little panic attack. I'm intelligent, you're intelligent, and they were like, you have to write a treatment plan, you have to come with it. I'm like, what? How are we gonna, I'm not smart enough to come up with that. This guy has it, and they are in, don't reinvent the wheel, this man is brilliant. But when you look up, there is no reactive attachment disorder in there. There's no attachment issues in there. There's PTSD though. There's conduct disorder, and you know what their objectives and their interventions are? Assess for conduct disorder. Kids that are killing people and, you know, setting fires and destroying property, assess them, okay? And then what?
Yeah.
Assist them. How are you gonna do that? And this is JOMSMA, he's great, but when you look at the JOMSMA for PTSD, numbers 19 through 24 on there, parent management training. When I say 90% of what I do, I live this in the work field, I live this, that's how you fix these kids. You change the whole way that the parent thinks about it and presents it. So what, when the child, look at the triggers. Well, when the child has chocolate candy, he goes berserk. or when the child visits dad or visits Aunt Sally or whatever, and you see, you know, when the child doesn't get his nap, then he's reactive. One of the objectives on here was to talk about, well, there, I know there's a slide for this, about how the inside, but this is probably the most important thing that I can stress with reactive attachment disorder, is that it's not a sick child. It's not just a sick child, it's a broken family. The child's reactive behaviors are a symptom that things are not well, but it's a whole, the whole family needs to heal from the inside out, both individually and corporately. So theoretically, we use some Adler, we use some CBT stuff, but we use primarily, I don't know if you've heard anybody talk about like Piaget today with the developmental stuff. We'll have a child that's 11 that's driving us crazy because he's acting like he's 4, because he's very egocentric, because he doesn't understand. He wants it, he doesn't understand, he's not quite narcissistic yet. We have those too. But there's some that have that pre-operational stage development. They really are stuck at 4 years old. And they act like they're 4, and you want to slap them and say, you're not 4, you're 11. You gotta deal with this. And Greenspan wrote a fantastic book called Developmentally Based Psychotherapy. So family systems is huge. It's probably the biggest one that we use, because we get moms, we have two sets of moms. One set of moms went out and adopted. They went out, they intentionally decided to bring a child into their family. They planned it, they prayed for it, they paid for it. And then the child rejects them. And you know, the mom is like, well, I'm gonna make you look. It's just the child might trigger mom back to when she was rejected at 3 or 4 or 5 by her dad or stepdad or mom or whatever. The second set of families that we have are kinship parents, grandparents raising kids, raising grandkids. And that's a whole different dynamic, because they didn't volunteer to take this on. There's a lot of resentment often. They're elderly, a lot of them are disabled. They don't want to be raising kids, they feel stuck. There's a lot of different stuff that you need to deal with from a systemic issue. Structural and obviously attachment focused with Murray Bowlby. So we talk about this is all fear-based, all where they don't feel safe, and it's their perception versus reality. So if they believe that moms abandon, because that's what moms do, because that's what they've done in the past, then they're gonna expect that you're gonna abandon them too. And that's not necessarily reality, that's just their perception. So their distorted perceptions are, I'm not in control of my life, I can't trust anyone to take care of me, I've had to meet my own needs, therefore I must gain control. And for some reason, I can't really explain the etiology of it, but for some reason that means they have to use it in a negative way, by destroying property or threatening to kill themselves or hurt somebody or however, you know, some really crazy negative. But the reality is that the way that they really get power is in learning to control themselves and respond in a positive way instead of using negative behaviors. So we use the choice consequence model all the time. This one is the one that represents that the inside matches the outside. So in this depiction, obviously, there's a lot of angst going on. The kid inside is like, oh my gosh, I'm in a new home, I'm gonna be rejected, how bad do I have to be, I might as well just get it over with. So he creates reactive behaviors. He might smear poop on the wall. Oh, that's not bad enough for you, and he'll kill the cat. Is that bad enough? And you see some crazy reactive behaviors. It's self-defense. The kid is saying, I expect that you're gonna reject me, I expect you're gonna hurt, you know, you're not gonna like me anyhow, I'm just gonna get this over with for you and me anyhow. And it's all fear-based. On the other hand, what we see in practice is that they'll start feeling bonded inside and the reactive behaviors will settle. And so everything will smooth out. And then they're like, oh my gosh, I'm bonding. I can't bond because that's scary because they're gonna hurt and reject me. And so it'll spur up. And it's, you know, the parents have to know that that's a pattern until trust is really built, and until they learn, they say, okay, you're gonna love me no matter what. Because it is cyclical sometimes, where it's that pattern where the child feels unsafe. So maladaptive schemas. Our kids do crazy stuff. We had one that was a screamer. I'm just gonna give you, her parents hadn't been out of her house other than for work for 2 years. They couldn't go on a date, they couldn't have a babysitter, they couldn't do anything, go out to dinner. They would shop at midnight while one parent was home with her in bed. It was just crazy. She was 9, she was adopted from an orphanage. I'll give you a case study on her so you could take it home and really kind of digest it and look at it. It's got a treatment plan in there that's got Johnsma stuff in there. But she came to me, they hadn't been out of their house in 2 years, and they were done, they were exhausted, they were ready to terminate on her. And she started screaming. Just screaming, for no good reason. And at my house is a no scream zone. So I live in the country, my neighbors know I have crazy kids, my animals don't care, and if you want to scream, you can scream as loud and as long as you want to outside. So we open the door, we stick her out, she's not locked out or anything, but when she's done and she can act like a lady, she can come back in. Hours. Well, she finally learned that wasn't going to work really well for us. You know, they do it in the grocery store. Mom, can I have a lollipop? Mom say no. And the kid will escalate and whine. And mom's looking around because people are staring. They have these really crazy schemas. But this little girl, 5 months later, her parents came to visit. And they visited every other week and stayed at the house with us for a couple of days at a time. But we decided we were going to go to the aquarium. And these kids are not my equal or superior, so I don't need their permission to go anywhere. So I usually don't tell them where we're going. We just get in the car. They need to get used to that. Because some of them have this, I'm equal to you, where are we going, what are we doing? That's on a need-to-know basis. You get there, you need to know, you know. And so usually I don't tell them where we're going or what we're doing, but this day it's 2 hours from my house to the aquarium, and we were going to carpool to save gas. So I sat her down, 5 months in, I'm thinking she's solid. She's got some good tools. And I said, all right, here's the plan. We're going out to dinner, we're going to the aquarium. She starts screaming. Stick her outside. All right, when you work it out, we'll go. 3 hours. She's still screaming. And I'm like, so I realized she was trying to sabotage. And we didn't want to give her the power to do that. So I went out there and I gave her new choice consequence. We used choice consequence. Put all the power in their lap. Okay? And we always give it, you don't do punishment after the fact. They always know what the consequence is in advance. So in this case, I said, all right, we're going. There's two ways you can go. You can get a grip and you can ride like a lady in my car. Or you can keep screaming and you can walk. What's it going to be? So she had her two choices and her two consequences. If she rode like a lady, got a grip and was respectful, she could ride in my car. If she was acting like a nut, she was walking. And she knew I was serious enough to have done it. And so she stopped immediately and got in my car and we went. She and I stayed out. I brought food from home so she didn't eat, but she didn't keep us from going either. So the next day I said to her, all right, dude, well, if you could use your words, because a lot of times these kids don't have communicate, they speak English, they can speak very eloquently, but they can't express themselves. I don't know why. And so she says, oh, well, that's easy. She said, in the past, anytime my parents wanted to go anywhere, I'd start screaming and we wouldn't go. So I said, in the past, anytime your parents wanted to do something fun, you used your power in a negative way and nobody had fun. Yep. And she's proud of herself. And I said, instead of using your power in a positive way to gain control of yourself and mind your manners so that everybody could have fun, including you. And it was like a light bulb. I mean, she never screamed at my house again. She was there another 4 months before she went home with her parents. But the crazy, crazy ways that they use negative, that's ridiculous. You're going to learn about schemas. It doesn't even make sense. Don't they want to go have fun?
So are you saying that it's all about control? They feel like their lives are out of control, so they do whatever they can to control, whether it's negative or not.
It's power and control. It's I have the power to make nobody go. Mm-hmm. If I scream, it's a control in a way, but it's not. I'm not sure I necessarily agree with everybody says, well, they have to have power, and they have to have control, they have to come. I'm not sure if it's that so much so that if they're in control, then you're not. Mm. And not necessarily over them, because in that case, if she wanted to have control, she'd want to have fun. I mean, I'm going out to dinner and I'm going to an aquarium. Are you kidding me? But it so consumes their rationale, they're not even rational. It's just, I can have control over this because this has worked in the past. I mean, this kid screamed for 10 hours at my house one day. 10 hours. Didn't get hoarse. Police came to my house. They're friends. You know, didn't get hoarse. Didn't. But she'd pause and she'd peek and she'd look and see if she had an audience, and if she did, she'd start over afresh. And she'd wind down. Very exploitive, incredibly exploitive. You know, when I talk about disinhibited social engagement disorder, these are the behaviors that you'll see in both RAD and DSED. When you hear about clinicians say, the ones in black are the ones from RAD. The ones, you'll see some overlap, ones that are bolded, like lack of conscience, sexually provocative, that's both RAD and DSED. Mm-hmm. Incessant chattering, presenting as superficially charming. This little girl, my children went to horse camp. Got her on a Saturday, they started camp the next week on a Monday. Didn't really know her, so didn't know what she's gonna do. She'd killed three dogs and two cats. And so she's not allowed to touch animals at my house. And so I had the conversation with her about, we're going to the stable, you are not allowed to touch animals. And so this is the pathology of the DSED. So somebody had a horse in cross ties and was brushing him, and she very sweetly batted her eyes. Is his nose very soft? And the lady says, well, yes, it is. You can touch it. And don't you know that little kid turned and looked at me like, ha. She knew exactly what she was doing, because I either had to let her touch it, or I had to look mean and nasty and hateful and say, no, she's not allowed to touch it. And I can't go up and say, hey, Joyce, she's not allowed to touch her horse because she kills animals. Is that okay with you? You know? So she knew exactly. She put me in a situation, triangulated, to where the adult looked bad. Very pathological. We're adopting a little girl out of a failed adoption. That's three. She just turned four. We've had her 9 months. First thing she did, never met me. She was 3 years old and 4 months when I met her. And first thing she did, cutest thing you've ever seen. She's from South Korea. I'm telling you, I'm a mom. She's the cutest thing I've ever seen. She batted her eyes. She reached out, grabbed my hand, and pulled me in close. But she was trying to get candy. And at three, it's not a big deal. But at 8 or 10 or 12, if you're exploiting people to get what you want, that turns into borderline. I mean, that turns into some seriously ugly stuff. We see this is, I wanted to talk about that here. Because when you talk about kids that have reactive attachment disorder, the parents will say they have no conscience, they have no empathy. And one of the most fascinating things that we have seen is the little girl from China we were talking about, the screamer. She had all 9 characteristic traits of personality disorder. You need 5 to be diagnosed. You can't diagnose personality disorders till they're 16. I wouldn't want to diagnose them anyhow, because it's like a death sentence. There's just no. But she had all 9 of narcissistic personality disorder. So she met that criteria. She had 6 of histrionic and 5 of borderline. So she could have died, if she was 16, she could have been diagnosed by somebody with all 3. And so, you know, narcissists, they think they're supreme and that you're not as good as them. They kind of have that lack of conscience and lack of empathy because you're not equal to them. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's just kind of who they are. And borderlines devalue, that's kind of who they are. But what we see is they cycle through the personality traits. Huge personality traits. I don't want to diagnose them with disorders, but this little girl, she would say, I want something. Which means, I'm the princess, you're the queen, you're not moving fast enough, hello. And when I didn't jump to it, she'd get very theatrical and dramatic, that histrionic. So the first one was narcissistic. I'm telling you what I want, you should serve me. Then she'd go dramatic and theatrical, the histrionic traits. And then when that didn't work and I still didn't give her what she wanted, then she'd do the devaluation of the borderline. I was the worst person on the planet, unless I was stroking her ego. I mean, it's just, and then, you could see this pause where she'd stop and she'd think this isn't working, and she'd go right back up to the histrionic. Maybe thinking I didn't hear her the first time. So she'll sedate it again, and they cycle through. It's fascinating.
It really is, because I'm thinking of a really close friend that they fostered and then they ended up adopting. They adopted at age 12. He had 2 other, basically it was just a neglect case, mm-hmm. but he exhibits a lot of these behaviors that you're talking about. Like, he wants to be in control. Like, when he first came to their house, he was literally chewing on the walls.
Yep.
And, so yeah, like what you're saying, really, like, cause she's my very close friend. So I know. And
my contact information is in here. So when I give it to you, just have him call me.
Yeah.
We donate services for that.
Oh, really? Mm-hmm. Yeah, because they obviously, you know, they adopted, you know, through an agency, but they are continuing to have a lot of behavioral problems with him, even though he's been with them like 4 years. I mean, he like was sneaking out in the middle of the night, stealing from neighbors, and he thinks he knows better than everybody. Like he, and especially towards women. Mm-hmm. So I guess that has something to do. But I'm just wondering, like, if anyone's even presented this term, because I've never heard of this term. But then
reactive attachment disorder.
Yes, I'm very new to the program. My undergraduate is in biology.
Oh, that's the term they throw out for everything now. Everybody's RADs, and they're not. It's a spectrum. There are attachment issues. Not, I mean, there's biological kids, and I tell you, I'm really big on electronic intrusions. I am big on turning off the phone. My kids don't have video games. We don't have television, because when we get these kids, I have kids that will, a teenager will, Mom, can I play the video game? No. So he'll go in the kitchen and he'll beat up Mom, physically assault her so that he gets sent to his room so he can get his video game fixed. Mm-hmm. And so when we have kids come in, there's no electronics. It does not come in my house. It doesn't even leave the house, the car with the family. If they are sending him with a Game Boy or a Wii, whatever, it stays in the car or it goes in the trash. I don't donate it to anybody because I think they're bad. I know I'm whacked in that regard, but...
Well, this child has ADHD as well, and I just think, like, that's something that I've learned in another one of my classes, is, like, when people come to him and say, like, I think my child has ADHD, he says the first thing is you need to take a break from technology.
Yep.
For, you know, a certain amount of time.
Absolutely.
You know, you need to look at the diet, you know, and then
Absolutely.
After this time, then we can see, like, is it really ADHD, or is it just too much video games? Is
right.
it too much sugar, you know?
It's, I'm big on that. We live on a farm. We raise our own food. So I raise everything organically I can afford to do. We have milk for milk goats. We have sheep for meat, turkeys and chickens. We raise organically. Eggs, we raise a garden. There's not a lot of sugar in my house because when you get kids with bipolar and stuff, they get flat aggressive on sugar. I live it. My children, I have 4 children that's still at home. I know. And so it's frightening.
I really appreciate you taking time, but I know you've got to go, but I'd love to get your contact information.
Yeah. I'm going to send you home with a case study. Here, you get one too, Nick. Thanks for coming. I was feeling very sad. Nobody wanted to hear me talk.
Well, you know how I felt.
Thank you.
Go back a few, real quick, go back a few slots.
Go back a few slots?
Yeah, go back to before the one with the flames.
Genograms are important. Don't forget genograms.
Yeah, go back to the one just before the... Okay, what happened?
Well, it's...
Okay. What does this remind you of?
Oh, yeah.
Not in control. Yeah. Orphan spirit, wrath,
yes.
Anger, trouble, and distress.
Yes.
It doesn't matter.
I was listening to you. I was like, man, I listened to his walk applied model, and it was a lot of correlation between what you were talking about.
Yeah.
And what
it doesn't, age makes no difference. It's still the sin nature.
Oh, I agree. And this applies to adults.
Yeah.
I mean, I happen to work with the population of institutionalized kids. And parents that are trying to train up a child that's really, so your friends that open their home and their heart to a 12-year-old that has been, but we don't know what happened to that 12-year-old, and I don't go back. But at some point, I mean, I don't think we need to know anything and everything that happened to the kid, me personally, but at some point the kid has a choice. He's going to be a victim or a victor. Is
right.
he going to wallow? You know, this little girl, I'm an orphan and I was left alone. Okay, well, that was when you were one and you're
mm-hmm.
10.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this child does that a lot too. Like, he leans on, oh, well, you know, I had to take care of my younger siblings, you know, when I was growing up. And he keeps talking about, like, you know, what his life was like before he came there. But he's been there for, like, 5 years now.
Right.
And, like, his situation is different. And I really commend you and people like my friend, you know, to do this, because it's been so hard for her, because, you know, he takes it all out on her. You know, she's the closest, she's the mom, and he is the nastiest. She
Does
loves him the
school?
Most. Yes, he goes to public school. He has an...
Does she have conflict with the school where he always... I had a little boy, he was 13 and 6 foot tall. He told the teacher, this is how smart they are. Teacher, can I have an extension on my time to study for my science test? Because Miss Christie, this is a foster kid. Miss Christie, she didn't feed me dinner last night. And I couldn't sleep because my stomach was growling the whole night long. And I'm not gonna pass your test. Teacher lady.
Oh yeah, he does stuff like that all the time, but the reality is that he didn't want to eat the food that was served or something.
Miss Christie
like
fed
this.
Him dinner last night, and so what happens is he'll get an A on the test, because the teacher thinks Miss Christie's this wicked witch, he'll get an A on the test, and she'll take him to IAM, right? And she'll take him downstairs and get him a snack. And he's like, ching, you're stupid. Mm-hmm. A lot of things that they do, the pathological lies, are to see, are you smart enough to know that I'm telling a lie? And it's a test, because if you're not smart enough, then you're not strong. And I'm going to teach you something to do really quick, because I've got to catch a plane.
Okay.
Put all your stuff down. Come over here. Teach your friend the lie detector test. You're going to use this in counseling, because Dr. Garzone loved this. So, the lie detector test. God, are you a Christian?
Okay,
so I am a Christian. God designed us, whether you're Christian or not, he designed you to be physically stronger when you tell the truth than when you tell a lie. And I'm going to show you. Okay. So these kids, they want to be strong.
Right.
Even though most of the time they do it in a negative way, get power and control in a negative way, it's all about being strong and powerful. Mm-hmm. And so they do these pathological lies, crazy, stupid lies. Hey, Mr. Nick, I had chicken and peas and mashed potatoes for dinner last night. And Nick's like, no, that sounds balanced. And he's thinking, you stupid twit. I had pizza last night, and you're not smart enough to know, so I'm stronger than you. I'm more powerful than you. So you stand with your feet shoulder width apart, and then which arm is dominant?
Right.
So when I tell you ready, you're going to hold your arm out.
Okay.
We're almost ready. But relax it, because you're going to have to be strong.
Okay.
And you're going to tell me a lie. My name is Penelope Cruz or something like that. You're going to brace it, and then when I say ready, you're going to brace your arm, and I'm going to push down.
Okay. So my name is Penelope Cruz.
Ready?
Yeah, my name is Penelope. Oh, wow.
Okay, so now you're going to do it, and you're going to tell me something true. Your name, whatever. Okay.
What my name is Carmen Kimball.
Ready?
Yes, my name is Carmen Kimball. Oh.
Okay, you can do it on a huge guy, you can do it on a little person. Mm-hmm. My little kids can do it. Uh-huh. But it's...
What's it called? What's the technique called?
The human lie detector test.
Human lie detector test.
And what kids do when you do it with teenagers, 12, 13, preteens, they're like...
Yeah.
They don't want to be weak.
Right.
And some of the kids really say... I mean, they really do stop lying because of it. I'm not 15 years I've been doing this. Because some of them are so geared on being powerful, they don't want to do anything that makes them not powerful. And if you can show them and they can see it, you don't give them advanced knowledge of what's going to, if your arm's going to go down, don't do that, because then they'll be like, here. Because I didn't
know. So fascinating. Thank you so much.
Yep.
Now, I was raised Catholic. I identify more like spiritual, but I certainly have a relationship with God, and I feel like I know him.
I wasn't born Catholic. I wasn't saved either.
Yeah.
Thank you, Nick. I better run.
Yeah, hey, listen, thank you.